Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I guess general career has all been in the mental health field in various projects and programs. Spent probably the first part of my career with at-risk youth and then transitioned into adults in the last five-ish years. And so, I mean, there's a whole lot of fun stories with all of that, but ended up in rugby. I met Angus and worked with rugby for the last few years, which has been, let's say it's aligned with the mental health field. All my skills have been put to use, but something that I really enjoyed that's been totally new. And then I started a private practice in the last 2 years. And so I'm doing individual counseling for adolescents and adults, and then still working with rugby. I guess I do a lot of program development across my career, a lot of programs. I think when Angus talks about commonalities, probably the biggest underlying theme there is just that entrepreneurism that we can't help but want to do it different, do it better, do it, improve it. So that's the overview.
Awesome. It's good. It's good to meet you. One, I'm fascinated. I was part of the Rugby Business Network in Sydney, Australia for a number of years and count a few former professional and national rugby players from Australia's friends still. So it's an interesting dynamic, and I can see where you turn that into the veteran space, you know, and help out with that. That's really cool.
Absolutely. There's so many commonalities, I think, and some pretty heavy themes that were really highlighting why it was such a good pairing. So can you tell me a little bit about your business and what you do?
Yeah, easy. So DOL Coach, for those of you listening, we are a platinum partner of the Institute of Project Management, which means basically that we can run certification and training as we see fit. And I got that status because I left the Institute as their global chief operating officer after a number of years working there. And I'm also a Dave Ramsey preferred financial coach. The acronym DOL is Latin for De Oppresso Liber, which is Army Special Forces motto for to free the oppressed. And I took that on as a moniker because I think that debt, poor processes, mental health, a lot of things oppress us that we don't realize. And I thought, you know, I also like Angus and I get along very well because I like the term coaching, because a lot of people don't realize that coaches can be on the sidelines. Tom Brady needs a coach, right? Lionel Messi, one of the greatest soccer players of all time, needs a coach, and coaches in the sidelines with a different view of the playing field and can align the pieces to the strengths and, you know, in competitive environments against the weaknesses of the opposition, further helping you overcome that that oppression that would stop you from doing that. And so far we've had pretty good results. We've built a great team with people like Angus and more on it, and we're expanding by the day with corporate partners and stuff. So I tell everybody I'm a pretty simple guy. If I don't like the way something's being done, I change it with very little thought to if, you know, other than knowing that it needs to be changed, the hurdles and the barriers and obstacles that will present themselves along the way. So that's probably one of the reasons Otis and Angus and I get along so well as we do.
Yes, sounds very familiar.
Yeah, it's hard to tell a former Green Beret that something can't be done, because we're like, you know, hold my beer, just wait, we'll show you how and get it done.
Right. And then you get there and you're like, but wait, we could do it better.
No, exactly. And just like I'm sure you're doing, if Angus is such a good friend of yours and so is Otis, once you realize the way things have always been done, it's almost very easy to see the capability gaps. And it doesn't mean it's right, because it's always been done that way. So there's always a challenge to bringing everybody on. And so to put in perspective, and this is where I think that you'll have a lot of key insights, right? When I first started at the Institute and we launched our certifications in the US, We got a lot of resistance, obviously, because there was a brand recognition from a certification provider over here, and it wasn't us. And so it was an uphill battle. But just, you know, I tell entrepreneurs all the time, and this is where I kind of want your feedback, right? Stay the course, keep the faith. And too many people just question themselves, question their abilities. They view some hurdle is a failure. And in reality, it's probably not nearly as major as they made it out to be in their head. So I'll defer to you, Doc, and say, why is it that most people view failure with such a negative lens like that, instead of picking themselves up, dusting themselves off and getting back on the playing field, no matter what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of kind of components to that, but at the very fundamental level, part of our survival mechanism is to need to improve what went wrong. So we can hear 10 good things, and the only thing we're going to remember is the one bad thing. And that's kind of part of our intrinsic need to improve as humans and our need to get better. It becomes a default. It becomes a barrier when we don't have the right supports around us to feel comfortable stepping out and growing, or feel confident enough that we have, you know, that we have the right skills and support system to do that. So it's part of our survival that we focus on the negative things or the bad things, but you know, without the right kind of support systems around us, that becomes more of a barrier than a area for growth. And another part of that is just, and you know, psychology calls it grit, and they've been studying that in different contexts. You know, what is that it factor that two people can go through the same thing and one of them fights through and succeeds and one of them doesn't? And they don't, I don't know that we fully understand what that it factor is, but you know, a lot of it is internal and a lot of it is the systems that we were raised by.
That's interesting. So one, I'm going to go back to you threw out the word systems, and I love that. But two, Angus already knows I'm going down this path. I'm a notorious reader. I read all the time. Grit, the book Grit by Angela Duckworth, is fantastic. We'll have to put that in the show notes so that people can pick it up. And I'll give it the caveat now that we didn't steer the conversation this way so that we can in any way profit from recommending a book by someone who I've never met and don't know, other than it is a fantastic book. But you said systems. And so I'll put it in perspective, right? I have three children, 18, 14, two boys and a three-year-old. And before people start wondering about the math, yes, same wife. We just still like each other and weren't planning on the three-year-old at the same time when our 14-year-old was 10.
Congratulations.
Nonetheless, so I'm trying to build systems within them as well. And I have that lens of not only being an entrepreneur, in a business owner and founder, but also being a parent. And I'm a voracious soccer coach as well. I love soccer and coaching the game. And my 14-year-old is highly competitive in the game, but I'm trying to always arm them with systems as well. So what are some kind of, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, I apologize in advance, but what are some of these systems that we could talk to people about to better put systems in place? Obviously a support network, that's an easy one we'll get to in a moment, but what are some internal systems that people can do or build so that failure and that negativity isn't so present in their life all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I wouldn't want to go so far as to generalize parenting as the same thing as leadership, but there are some absolute parallels. So, and you know, I think in both areas, when we talk about systems, there's a few things that, you know, that I see as really important in people who are going to who do have the will, you know, that grit, that aspect of them that wants to succeed and that can do so successfully. And I think part of that is the ability to fail successfully. And that's without, you know, again, kind of going back to the survival skills, failure is a highlight for us because it's an area that we need to improve to thrive, right? Failure is not a setback or a loss. It's a highlight of this is something that we need to improve on, and it's a lesson every time. But when parents or leaders treat failure as a negative, a punishment, something that can't be tolerated, then it becomes fear-based. And so when we're afraid of failure, we don't want to fail, and therefore we don't take the healthy risks to do so. And, you know, kids are a great example of that. If we don't allow them to take healthy risks and support them through failure, then they're going to be afraid to fail. And that creates a whole system of lack of support and confidence and things like that. So I think when we talk about systems, failure is integral in all of that. We have to understand the value of failure and then what success means by kind of redefining that as not the traditional success isn't the degree and the, you know, corporate job and the whatever we kind of think of success as, but success is it adds value to your life. And that, you know, a 7-year-old knows what adds value to their life. It's going to look a lot different than what, you know, your corporate leader is going to value as success, but honoring where success is at from the individual person. So I think systems is a interwoven support system all the way through. And I also think that adding that kind of personal aspect of that, honoring the individual perspective on the journey is all, those are all kind of part of the success.
No, love it. And for the record, as a leader of a company, I hope Angus agrees, I don't treat the people on the team as children. I don't try and treat them as their dad. In fact, I think if anything, I'm probably, maybe I'm too guilty of empowering too many people and then having to dial back that empowerment, because we see it in project management all the time that in a stakeholder engagement, right, the pinnacle of somebody with both high power within your project and high positive or negative or high positive interest in your project is to empower them. And I get to there very quickly. I trust a lot of people after, not initially, but after I get to know them and kind of skyrocket straight to that empowerment sphere. Now, you did say value, and I love that. And when you say 7-year-olds know what brings value to their life, it made me smile, because I think my 3-year-old knows what brings value to her life. And that's, yes, you know, milk in her bottle in her favorite movie on TV, right? So she's happy to do all that. It's interesting, though, and I'm going to go back just momentarily, apologies, but I know people, you know, especially former special operators, maybe not in the Green Beret world or the Army Special Forces world, but who look at failure. And in fact, my older brother, and I'm fairly positive he won't ever listen to this podcast, but he's a multimillionaire and incredibly successful, probably way more successful than I will ever be. But he's come out a few times to me and said, I've never failed once. Now he's a West Pointer. He's risen through an MBA program and multimillionaire status. And he said, I don't fail. I never fail. And that attitude is alive and well in his family as well. Whereas I'm the guy that say, you can't become a successful athlete, coach, parent, anything without some trials and failures. So how do we, to wrap this back to the permission, right? How do we give people permission to fail and let them know that, you know, that failure is not fatal. It's not catastrophic. The bulk of time, sometimes it very may well be, but how do we give people permission to fail as a system they can rely on so that they can learn what worked and what didn't work for them and nestle that into their brain somehow?
Yeah. And I think one of my favorite ways to kind of think about that is, and this is very much from education, but this a scaffolding approach to supporting someone. And so, you know, initially there's a whole lot of scaffolding in place to create a foundation and to allow the person to kind of show who they are, show what they have. And then you slowly start to kind of take down the scaffolding and allow them to stand on their own. And that's a very simplified kind of explanation of this very brilliantly worded theory. But, you know, the idea is that, and I think to what you're saying about how you run your company, the idea is to create opportunity and then make sure that the support system and the values are in place. If your company doesn't value failure as a benefit, then it won't, you know, the people who are involved won't feel comfortable failing. And, you know, when we talk about people who've never failed, I mean, not to get into any of your family stuff, but you know, perfectionism is a trauma response. It's a response to the fear of failure, and it can be associated with trauma. So creating a supportive environment that allows failure and that values the lessons and the success through failure. is probably one of the biggest pieces. So support and values.
Nice. Angus, what do you want to add that I'm not talking to thus far? Because you're freaking me out being so quiet. This is the quietest you've ever been.
Because I usually talk over him.
My brain is a whirly gig of questions. And I've got to draw one out. Actually, it's sort of a double-edged question, Darby, because interesting with Scott. Scott does walk the walk on what he says he is as a leader, which, you and I have a shared professional background and we know other people. I actually find it really unnerving. Not anything to do with Scott, but I'm just going, this just can't be true. No one walks this walk in this kind of leadership. Now, that's unfair because I'm sure there's a bunch of people out there who do walk a leadership walk or an entrepreneurial walk like Scott does. But they're so rare and so hard to find that when you do find someone that you can respect for that and you go, yeah, look, there's another person who walks that walk. It's like, oh, wow, is this like a unicorn? Is like everybody will wake up and it's a dream and it's like them just disappears in the mist. So I think the question is, there's two things. There's like, the first one is, what's the disconnect that, right? Because I believe in empowering people, been in some very robust professional environments where things fall down all the time and you cannot hold on to every little rein. It's just not possible. You just got to let it go. And worst case scenario, I've been in environments where you just sit there and you go, everything's rolling around me and I can't do anything. So I might as well just sit. It's like in my head, I visualize it as the tornado in The Wizard of Oz. It's just going and there's nothing you can do about it. So let it go. So where's the disconnect in systems or culture that doesn't enable people to actually be a little bit more like that?
Point blank, probably ego. But, I think when we're talking about the type of person that is a leader and the type of person that's an entrepreneur, I don't think that they're always the same person. So, and I see this in every kind of every industry, every field. And leadership is a very specific skill set. Being able to lead, being able to understand the bigger picture, being able to understand all the pieces and how they move around, and then to empower and inspire people to go there or to do that without them ever, really a leader can see the big picture where no one else can. I think, and so occasionally the entrepreneur and the leader is the same thing, which it sounds like that's what you are, Scott, but entrepreneurs often have really good ideas and they're really passionate about their ideas and they're really very specialized in what they're doing, but that doesn't always translate to leadership skills. And so I think that there's certain types of person, there's types of people for types of roles. And when I say ego, a huge part of that is being able to assess, where does your ego sit? And just because you're the entrepreneur and this is your baby and this is your idea, are you the right person to lead it or direct it or do every single piece of it? Where does your ego sit in the success of this? And I think probably one of the biggest barriers is, our ego gets in the way of allowing growth to happen because we're afraid to let go of a piece of our baby, our project, or we're, concerned that someone will lead it in the wrong direction, or we can't recognize that maybe we're not the right leader for this specific task. All these kind of little pieces that make up the component of building something new. And being an entrepreneur, leaders can lead companies that are already existing. You can be a leader and step into a role and take it in a new direction. That's very different than starting something from scratch or paving a path that's never been paved before. And, I always think of entrepreneurism like rolling a boulder up a hill. When you're creating something new, it's very tenuous. You're really like, you're holding on to it. And some days all you can do is hold it there. And that's all you have. But understanding how to build in all the pieces around that is a whole different animal than just having leadership skills.
It's interesting. Angus knows exactly what I'm talking about, and I'm not going to drop her name because I live in fear of her and she's going to kick my ass if I drop her name on a podcast. But I had this exact conversation yesterday afternoon with somebody on my team who I rely on crazily. But I said, you've got to learn to let some things go. And what I was talking about specifically were she and I will have meetings and working groups and lay tasks out. And because we're great project managers, we'll put due dates on the tasks and I'll just go and change a due date. And I had to tell her yesterday, when I was an executive in my past roles, both as a federal employee and at the Institute, I never could let go of a due date, right? If that thing said that it was due by the 2nd of November, by God, I'd be up till 11:59 PM, like making sure that thing was done. Now, if it's an arbitrary date, I just go easily be done on the 3rd of November, move the date. And well, and I'm also notorious for protecting, and Angus will tell you I'm being 100% sincere on this as well. I'm notorious for protecting my own quality of life because I do have workaholic tendencies and I can easily sit behind a computer 23 and a half hours of the day. But that, you know, I want to prioritize the things that I know need prioritized. But to your point with ego, too many people are afraid of that word. And I go, I have a massive ego on the things that I know I'm great at. And I'll tell you, I am exceptional with that, unapologetically. But too many people, you know, we want to be humble or perceived and this whole public perception of what we are. And so on the one hand, I'll get back to asking you your thoughts on being unapologetic. And on the other hand, I'll say that, when you said leaders and entrepreneurs aren't the same people, I agree with you. Oh, I could hug you if you were in their room with me. I agree with you so well. And I see this on mentor groups that Angus and I are part of and in other areas of our professional lives, in that entrepreneurs have the idea, but then they're the CEO or they're the founder and they don't know how to take that idea to execution. And I'll be very blunt, this will probably piss off a lot of people, and say veteran entrepreneurs are even worse at that because they either had shiny things on their collar or stripes on their chest or something, right, that they think enables them this innate ability to lead. And I'm going, it's two different realms. And I don't think I'm exceptional at both of those, but I do think that I know myself and I'm very self-aware in that if I'm weak in something, I'll figure out a way to get done or rely on those to pick up the ball and carry it for me. If I'm strong on something, I'll defend why we need to do it that way. But I'm also not wed to any systems or, you know, we just moved from Teams to Slack, which I think people want to kick my butt for as well. And I'm going, Teams wasn't hitting the ball for us, so we're moving. And if we identify a pain point, and so that's how I'll wrap this up and toss it back to you. I apologize. But I think one of the biggest responsibilities of a leader is in eliminating pain points for those within the organization and the entities in which they lead, right? And entrepreneurs, by their very nature, create pain points, because if I want to start a new project management certification in the U.S., that's a Mount Everest size hill of pain points that we've got to start trudging up and putting all the pieces on. But we beat ourselves up psychologically, and yet we hide our ego. And this is the question I have for you. Why are we so intent on hiding our egos and acting like we're humble because that's what LinkedIn or Facebook wants to hear, when we should be unapologetic about that which we're trying to do? So on the one hand, we're trying to appear humble and yet say, stay the course and keep the faith. Well, there's two different streams of thought there, right? I can't stay the course in what I know to be true. That's my true north, is in doing it this way, and yet be adaptable to that and appear humble. I either have to have an ego or I don't. So I'll leave it with you on that. Very well. I love where this conversation is going. I could talk to you for hours. So thank
you. And you know, I think, and when we talk ego, we're really stepping into the theories of mental health here. But you know, we associate ego with pride, and that's not always the same thing. So ego is an aspect of who we are as a human. It's part of our survival mechanism. Again, it's a core component of who we are. Our ego thinks it's trying to protect us. And it's our kind of our subconscious that is actively working to protect us. And that, but it's also not rational, right? So it's working to protect us from embarrassment. It, you know, thinks it's protecting us from criticism. It thinks it's protecting us from all these things, but it's not a rational consciousness. It's just, it's a kind of a fear-based consciousness. So in short, to the best way to address some of the things you're talking about, in my opinion, and you know, other professionals may have different opinions on this, but in my opinion,
well, they're not on the show, so they can keep their opinions to themselves for now.
They can debate. I would love to debate anytime.
There you go. We'll bring them on. If you have different opinions, we'll bring them back.
Yeah. I think, you know, point blank, addressing all of these things that you're talking about requires self-work, self-reflection, self-work, addressing your traumas, addressing your triggers, addressing your ego. You know, why is it acting the way that it is? Why do you feel being, you know, why do you feel like being proud of your project is prideful? You know, that's, those are two very, pride and proud are two different things. You know, you can be proud of the things that you built in a very genuine way, but your ego is trying to protect you from something, you know, and that's all, that's not to just plug individual counseling, but I mean, that is the benefit to me of addressing some of these, our internal shit, you know, that's, it's our responsibility to deal with our issues so that our impact on the world is genuine and beneficial.
Yeah, now I'm picking a fight with Mark Cuban, who I'm also sure is not going to listen to this podcast, so I feel safe in saying this, but on Shark Tank, Mark said, you know, failure is not an option, and he calls it FINEO, right, for his acronym, and I did some introspection on that for a while, and I said, well, if failure is not an option, then neither is success. And what I when I coach people on a professional side, and I do a lot of pro bono vetrepreneur coaching as well, and tell them, you know, stupid simple things like, look, you don't have enough money to bank to do this, or it's going to take you five times as long, or hey, that person's already doing the exact same thing, right? But one of the things, and this is more your realm than mine, but why are we so afraid of success? And I see that all the time, and that people work like crazy, like farm animals, right? They work and they slave and they go forward to this mission and this vision, and then they're terrified of achieving it. And for a long time, and I say that like completely transparently, I was terrified of success as well for a long time, and I'm not prideful in what we're doing. And I tell everybody, is kind of my catch-all now, I'm just getting started. We as a company are just getting started. And I say that with the lens of, we've trained over 10,000 veterans this year alone. And gotten 85% of them certifications in one calendar year. So 8,500 certifications in the veteran community in 1 year is pretty awesome. But a lot of people are just terrified of that success and saying that they're successful and saying they're winning. And we mentioned Otis McGregor, and Otis is a friend of all three of ours, but Otis starts a mastermind group that Angus and I are part of. And what he starts every single group with is, tell us three successes over the past week that you've had. And Angus will tell you, a lot of people have a very hard time naming and talking to those. Now, when we switch it to tell me a lesson that you've learned or a failure, everybody, right off the bat, it's a laundry list, right? So why are we both, you know, ego-driven, prideful, trying to be humble and terrified of success at the same time, if that's what we're actually... And it's probably much more of a topic too deep for this podcast, but I'll ask anyway, why are we terrified of success?
I think probably because what's been defined as success, again, it kind of comes back to what has been given to us. And if you take military, for example, success is very clearly defined for you. And, you know, stepping outside of that, you're, you know, you do A, B, and C, and then you get the next, you know, promotion and, or the next level or the next thing. Success is very clearly defined for you. So there's no, you don't have to define success for yourself. It's given to us. And that's in a lot of systems. The military is just a good example of a very structured one. In school, success is defined as good grades or high test scores, but does that equate to success in life? No. It doesn't. But, you know, we're still very connected to the defined systems of success that are in place for us. And so, you know, again, when we're talking about stepping out of what we already know, that's a very scary thing for people to do. And regardless of who you are, you know, to be transparent, that's my biggest crux has been my own self-confidence and knowing that stepping out and doing these things you know, on my own, or even though no one else is doing them at this age or this way, that, you know, and I have to overcome my self-doubt every single time. And it's a battle every single time. And that's where that comes back to, you know, all these systems are in place defining success for us. But at the end of the day, to navigate that, we have to come back to where did that self-doubt come from in the first place? Like, why do I even feel that way in the first place? And I've had to do a lot of work on why is that my crux? You know, why is that my kryptonite? Why does that get in my way? And that's regardless of the systems that are telling me this, I still have to take ownership for my own path. And that's hard to do. It's really hard.
And ownership's one of those words, right? I don't ever use the word trigger, but it is triggering for people. I feel that, you know, we don't tend to have a lot of ownership in things nowadays. Possessions, yes, all day long. And we all like our possessions. And I'll stave the, you know, if you can't afford it and are paying for it on credit, like it's not a possession. You don't own it. The credit card company or the bank does. But possessions we feel okay owning, but why don't we feel okay owning our ideas or in vocalizing those ideas? And again, this comes from my history, because when I would put out, I used to have, and I'm not mocking PTSD by any means, but I would almost have like a PTSD episode in Australia, scripting a LinkedIn post, just knowing that there are gonna be negative comments. And it took me too long, I'll say, to wake up and go, it's just some jackass on LinkedIn voicing his or her opinion. Why does that matter so much to what you're doing? Nobody else is. It's not derailing the company, you know? So why do we put, again, I'm not going to say why, because I keep asking the same thing, but it's interesting to me that we don't ever take ownership in what we know is true. And I see this in parents. On one of my son's soccer teams, and he plays for 3 at the moment. One of the parents, the kid is notorious for getting yellow cards for being kind of a ruffian on the field and mouthing off to the referees and all that. And the dad's always, on one hand, acting like he's opposed to that. And I told him just yesterday, I said, clearly you're not opposed to it, because this third game in a row where he's got sent off for mouthing off to a referee. One time my son does that, he's never going to do it again, right? So we don't take ownership in our own beliefs, and we talk out of one side of our mouth and act out of the other. Mm-hmm. And it does my head in, because I find myself, I can't surround myself with people like that, because I just dislike it so much. And it's almost like I've had this, you know, cosmic awakening, right? That I'm going, it's okay to have beliefs that aren't the norm, because the norm, but here's something else I'll tell you. The new generation coming up today, they're not constrained like we were at all by that. They're questioning the status quo, and they're kind of getting beaten across the head by it, by, you know, the older folks, right? And I'm going, I love it. Like, I want people to, you can question, but you have to know your place, right? And sometimes you can't be a brand new person in a corporation and tell the CEO it shouldn't be done that way without cause. But it's interesting to me that so many people just don't act on their beliefs and go from that. And that's what this whole redefined and relevant thing is, right? It's don't let society tell you, well, why do you do it that way? Because we always have. Why do you do it that way? Because I have to go to college because my mom always wanted me to go to college. Do you want to go to college? So I'll end all that and say, who is a professional role model of yours that you look back to and go, you don't have to name them if it's going to be embarrassing, obviously, but who's somebody that you look back on and go, this person really helped me redefine myself and realize the relevance that I did bring to the industry that I'm attached to, and I'm successful because of that realization?
Yeah, absolutely. And I happily name him and embarrass him anytime, but when I was young, I worked with horses, and I had a real close family friend that worked, trained horses, and I lived at his house, and Jerry Dennis is his name, but he had a philosophy of life that was purely centered around accountability. And I, you know, you use ownership. I love the word accountability, and it's forever a theme in everything that I've done, everything that I do, and everyone that I work with. I have, you know, really random friends and random experiences all over the place. And the one theme that to me is, because I couldn't figure it out for a long time, what is it? And it's accountability. It's that you know, willingness to take a risk, but also take accountability for what's happening. And I think, you know, I learned it through horses at a very young age. You know, that's whatever the horse is doing, it's because I've done it. You know, it's not the horse is responding to me. It's not the horse's fault. You know, they're bucking because I did something wrong, or they're, you know, they're not listening because I'm not communicating well. And it's, there is no one else to blame except for me. And so I think that that was a early learned lesson that has gotten me through a lot of things. But also when, you know, accountability seems like a very scary word, but it's, and I, you know, I tell my clients this all the time, it's empowering. It's empowering to know that what you're doing, you have control over the impact in the world. You have control over your life. It's not accountability in terms of shame or guilt. It's accountability in terms of empowerment. These are your choices and you get to own them, right or wrong. You get to take that, you know, you get to take that on. And, you know, we have systems beyond, you know, it's easy to say, don't listen to society, or, you know, your family has this serious generations of alcoholism, why would you drink? You know, it's easy to say things like that, but they're very ingrained in us. And overcoming that, it, you know, self-work and self-reflection is not for the faint of heart. It's hardcore shit to go through. And I have so much admiration for the people that do, and the people that come in and do counseling, and the people that face, you know, they turn around and face generations of trauma or generations of guilt and shame. It's hard work. And so accountability is a huge, powerful word, but it's hard, you know, it's not an easy thing to obtain.
We're going to have to name this episode accountability. I love the word. And I'll double down and say, not only does it lead to empowerment, but it also, every leadership poll, like what qualities you look for in a leader, right? There's one word that's in the top five every single time. It's integrity. And accountability and integrity are hand in glove. You can't be a leader and do things contrary to what you're putting out and not have accountability, right? We've seen that with, you know, Enron and a lot of the global financial crisis stuff, and a lot of leaders that had zero accountability and no integrity in whole organizations, and, you know, millions of people potentially impacted by that, right? And so it's interesting, and I love the phrase, because do you feel, and this is an open question for both of you, do you feel that we're doing a good job of teaching our kids in the younger generation accountability, or are we just checking the box and saying, oh, they'll get it from somewhere? You know, Barney teaches not to waste water when you brush your teeth, and the Wiggles teach this. And as we get up in age, right, they'll gain it from somewhere. And it's most from the babysitting TV.
Angus, do you want to get a word in?
I got to go with my gut on that. So it's got to be no. And the reason for why, I think there's too many people in too many roles that want to boilerplate everything. Human nature, and I hear myself say this over and again, human nature loves the path of least resistance. And therefore it's easy to get in line, toe the line, not think for yourself. So, and I've been resonating around this and psychological safety. So if I look back at my own professional history, there are instances, projects I've run or whatever, where my executive has asked me to do stuff that I would never ask anyone to do today. I look back at it then and go, wow, that was quite significant. And outside of my own, you know, desire to validate myself through crazy project management, I look at the world today and I go, you see people in, coming back to leadership and leadership accountability is saying to people, I want you to do something, but they don't give them the tools, don't give them resources. So they want to be, but they've got to be accountable for it. So at the first opportunity, we're offering up an opportunity to fail and then criticize. I see that everywhere. You don't just see it in business, you see it on the sports field, you know, coming back to the games we love, empowering players to play. Well, I'm right back to the beginning when we were talking about value sets. A 7 or 8 year old kicking a ball around, run around in the park, really isn't interested in their sprint metrics or how many goals they're going to kick. They just want to be out with their mates, and their mates are there as a snapshot in time in front of them right then. But then when you see the parent getting really agitated because they're not on a pathway at age seven to become Lionel Messi or an equivalent, it's just like irrational. It's completely irrational. And it doesn't, that kind of irrationality doesn't seem to be linked to, in my mind, to your background or your upbringing. It just seems to be like an irrationality that seems to transcend all parts of culture. So I think, coming back to the original question of accountability, I'm not convinced we're doing a good job, because in so many organizations, there's that fear of failure, right? And failure hits the bottom line. And if you fall down, then we go immediately into blame the person instead of taking a step.
Or the messenger. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so I look back in my own life, I was held accountable for a number of things when I was younger, which stayed with me as I was older. But then as soon as I remember graduating high school, going into the real world, realizing, oh, there's a lot I don't know, and then discovering the hypocrisy of leadership, right? Which is like, oh, once I'm up here and I've achieved this status, I can turn around and treat you like a big melon. And I was just... That's the fallacy of human nature, to my mind. I'm going to hand this back off to you, Darby, because I can see you smirking over there. And I'm sure you've got something to contribute.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I read this, and I wish I could remember where to credit it, but I really love the metaphor of a pendulum, because I think it's so fitting. So I think if we kind of take a step back and look at generations of how people were raised and how our society has evolved, you know, our generation, our parents' generation, was very, very strict, very, you know, be seen and not heard. You only do what we say you do. You don't think for yourself. You only listen, you know, and that pendulum has swung and is now kind of come up the other way. And it's now we're afraid to take away choice. We're afraid to give limits. We're afraid, you know, we want our kids to be free and think for themselves and have, you know, access to all of these things. And, you know, ideally, and I'm an optimist forever, I annoy Angus with it, but I do think that the pendulum will come back down. So I think, currently we're doing a good job? I think we're always doing the best we can, but I do think that there's room for improvement, and you can't have freedom without reasonable limits. And the limits aren't imposed by society or other people, they're imposed by the responsibility of our impact on the world. So yes, you can say anything you want to say. You have free will and freedom of speech, but you are also responsible for the impact of that statement. And so that's where I think responsibility lies, not in rules or necessarily arbitrary, this is how it's supposed to be, but in your personal responsibility for what you're putting into the world. You are responsible for that. And I don't know that we do a great job of giving our kids that ownership or accountability.
Can I throw a question at you both then around that? Is I'm just thinking about my own rebellious attitude, and then also my own attitude to accountability, which is I like being held accountable and I don't mind being responsible. So is that nature or nurture?
Both.
Took the words out of my mouth. I was just saying, I don't know, both. So when I was coaching soccer at Academy in Australia, I had different age groups, right? From 12-year-olds to 18-year-olds. But for the younger kids, the parents would come up to me after the game, and I never criticized any of the younger kids specifically for taking a shot, even if the shot went, you know, if the goal was here and the shot went that way. And they said, you never criticize. And I had this conversation probably half a dozen times at least. And so I said, you never criticize them taking a shot. Why is that? And I said, I can teach a kid to dial that shot onto the goal and to make it a more competitive shot. I can't teach a kid to look at it and have the desire to try and score a goal. Now, with coaching, obviously comes the when do you take the shot and all the other stuff, right? Versus passing and all the other pieces. But Darby, you said something very interesting there, which is free will and free speech. And again, 18-year-old, 14-year-old, and 3-year-old. So I've had these conversations with a number of people, and I'm going, free speech is the most important thing that we all possess, comma, but you have to be aware of the implications of what you're saying. So is my two sons have grown into, you know, teenagers and what I view as a fine young man. They know that they can say, there's no word off limit. There's no phrase off limit. They can say it. There's going to be an immediate repercussion, but if it's something, you know, contrary or hurtful, right? So what do you think as far as where we are now with cancel culture and everything else? And I know it's a ticking time bomb, but as far as taking free speech away from people and further constraining, because the young generations aren't dumb, right? They know what we're doing. And when they see that, all we're teaching them is you can't have an opinion unless it's this opinion. And I just want to open up to you, who's a lot more educated than I, is this jackass power washes my window outside right during the podcast. I'm going to put myself on mute and shut up.
Yeah, and that it is tricky. I think it's tricky to navigate that while having empathy with all sides. Personally, I see the issue as everyone has their opinion and their stance and really feels comfortable standing there and pointing out the problem. So we're very good at pointing out what the problem is all the way around. We know what the problems are. We know it's okay to do this. We know it's not okay to do that. We know we approve of this. We don't approve of that. But all we do is stand there and point at the problem over and over and over and reiterate, this is the problem. This is the problem. This is the problem. And my biggest pet peeve, we'll call it, is we get stuck there and we don't ever move towards a solution. And I run out of patience and find it really difficult to work with people who are unwilling to move towards a solution and just want to point at the problem. So cancel culture, you know, freedom of speech, all of these things are all happening, but they're only pointing at the problem. And at no point are we coming past the next barrier to what is the solution. Okay, we know that these are hot topics in the world today. We know that there are problems associated with them. You know, gay rights, police brutality, all of these things are hot topics in the world today. And we know that there are problems associated with them on both sides, all sides. What is the solution? Where are we going next? And it just becomes very much pointing fingers versus, you know, what are we gonna try? What are we gonna do to make it up, to solve the issues or to work towards a solution?
In Army Special Forces, we call those types of people triple P's for problem people or problem person. And the alternative, and they're the people, like you said, they just bitch. And they just, that's the problem. This isn't done right. This isn't set up. I'm not set up here. It's just all negative all the time. In the contrary, the opposite of them are problem solution people, right? Those are the people that when they see a problem, their inherent nature is to go, all right, well, I can actually tweak that this way and fix it. And so when they present, if I present Angus with a problem, I have to go, and hey, boss, here's also two or three ways I thought that we might put this problem in place, right? And we all like working with solution people, but we're all very forgiving of the triple P's, right? These highly negative. And Sherry Lynch, who will be a guest on this show eventually, she's deconflicting her calendar. She's the co-host of the Bob and Sherry radio show, which is nationally syndicated on Armed Forces Radio. And I've been on their show a few times. And whereas I'm more conservative leaning, she's exact opposite political ideology, background, everything to me. And if you were to look at us on paper and hear us talk, you'd probably think that we'd immediately butt head. And I think of her, I love her family. But we sat down and I laughed at a few things that I thought were moronic that she said. She laughed at more than a few things that were moronic that I said, but neither one of us reverted to name calling. I wasn't throwing out snowflake and she wasn't calling me a Nazi or anything else, right? So we just sat down and it turned into, after the radio session ended at like 11 a.m., we sat there for like 5 hours in the radio station, just talking with the producer and everybody. And it was one of the best conversations I've ever had. And were you to tell me like, hey, Scott, we're going to put you in a radio booth in a small radio station room with a very liberal, very well-known and very public person and have a 5-hour conversation, I start cringing, right? I'd go, oh, man, this is going to be a recipe for disaster. But it's helped define me because I understand it. You know, I don't have the answers for everything, neither do you or Angus, but if we work collaboratively and together, I'm pretty sure that we can get the somewhat of a right answer to a lot of these problems, right? But, and it's one of the buzzwords in project management, which is communication. We just have to start communicating a lot more effectively.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think what you're describing in conversations like that, and I think that this is missing in a lot of leadership programs, a lot of spaces. But what you're describing is a conversation that's, it's not just communication, but it has, it's with empathy. And that's a really, really challenging thing for us as people, because we don't practice it and we're not very good at it. Fundamentally, we're not. But it's stepping into a conversation like that, like you're describing, and I am notorious. I have those all the time. And I can't help myself. But the when you step into conversations like that with empathy, as you know, understanding why would Scott's perspective be this way, and why is this important to him, and you know, what are the values that he has, and then you start to realize that you're saying similar things from different perspectives, and then you find commonality, and then collaboration and communication come very easily. But you know, we think of collaboration as a battle of, you know, how do I get part my way and part your way, you know, or how do I get my points across?
How do I understand?
That's not collaboration. Collaboration is laying every piece on the table and picking them apart and understanding what fits together and then what you can make it work out of that. It's a very creative process, but you have to have empathy involved in the conversation.
People are going to think I set this up, and I'll put out there right now, I've never seen or met Darcy. We connected on LinkedIn this morning about an hour and a half before. Darby.
You proved your point.
I proved my point. I haven't met until about an hour and a half prior, but Darby and I only met today. Her and Angus go way back, but Angus will tell you one of the guiding principles that we do every course and every piece of communication out there. And I'm stealing from Donald Miller, the New York Times bestselling author, when I say this, but we look at it through the lens of empathy and authority. So we have empathy for, if we're teaching a high school course, what they're trying to go through and what they're trying to learn. And then the authority through our platinum partnership with the Institute, the empathy and authority for financial coaching. You're in debt. You don't want to be. I've been in debt. It's horrible. It sucks. The authority is, I'm a Dave Ramsey preferred coach, right? So we look at everything, and I love that. I think that's, I made a tick mark like four or five times you said the word empathy. And I love it because we're failing in that department across society. I'm not evil because I'm a 40 plus year old white guy with a beard, right? You're not the enemy because you think differently. Well, Angus says I am evil, but it's good to be different and it's okay. But we have to be comfortable that, hear me out here, everybody. Somebody might have a contrary opinion that's actually better and more informed than yours. So is, but we all have the God-given right and the freedom to say that and voice that out. But we need to, again, to Darby's perspective, word, we need to make sure we have empathy when we're talking to people. And if you find yourself being unempathetic, look in the mirror, right? Like sometimes looking in the mirror, it's a lot harder to see the person looking back at you. And one of the things I love most about the Dave Ramsey financial approach is, right, he says, you are the reason you're broke, but you're also the reason that you're not going to be broke. Because when you look in the mirror, you have to account to yourself for your habits and your behaviors. And winning with money is discipline and behavior modification. It's not some, if I take a Harvard MBA course, I'm all of a sudden going to be a millionaire, right? It's a behavioral guide, but you have to understand empathy and authority for everything that we do and touch.
I've actually got a, on that, Scott, I've got a question for both of you, and I'd love to hear both of your perspectives. And I think all three of us on this call at some point in our life has inherited a culture or inherited a situation which is not endemically empathetic or open-minded. And I think in my own recent history, I've inherited a couple of situations professionally where actually the culture inside the organization is, you know, to use another buzz phrase, toxic. Practically, and this is something we could share with the audience, what would you like top two or three things if you inherit a culture, but you're coming in as someone who's not only got to try and keep your organization or the team or whatever on track, performance wise, but you realize that's part of the issue with disengagement or sub performance. How do you start to turn that around?
Darby, do you want to go first? Or?
Sure. So, you know, I'm probably always going to come back to this because fundamentally, this is just what I believe and this is part of my profession. But if you have not, if you don't have a really strong hold on your values and your direction and your system, then you'll do two things. You'll either get in and continually hit against brick walls, or you'll get in and you'll conform. So you'll become a part of the toxic culture. And if you don't have that kind of, if you haven't checked your own, and I know you don't like the word trigger, but I love it. And I think we should talk more about them. But if you don't, if you haven't checked your triggers or your, or if you don't have a strong understanding of what your purpose is, what your morals are, what your, if you're coming into a toxic culture, it's, those are the two ways it's going to go. If you come into a culture with those kind of in place, you know what you're bringing, you've checked your ego, you've done your own self-work, you know your accountability, and you step into any situation with empathy, then you will be able to kind of sort out why is it toxic in the first place and what are the contributing factors, what, who's not being heard and who is contributing to this and why. You know, you'll find all of the pieces that you need to start to pull out the workings of the organization. But, and you know, I think empathy is a word that we use a lot nowadays that we don't fully understand. We're not very good at it, and that's to have empathy. With not having empathy, we're not taught how to have empathy. It's not something that our families are very good at. It's not something that was taught to us in school or anywhere else. We're just not very good at it. And so it's more challenging than it sounds to just be empathetic.
No. And for the record, I don't hate the word triggered. I just think of it as too many people have an excuse when they use it, they came up. But my top two or three things, this is going to seem overly blunt, but one, if you inherit a culture and it is toxic, not everyone should be there. And you need to, I'm never a zero defect guy, meaning the first sign of weakness or whatever, right? You're not given a corrective action and set on your way. At the same time, once you delineate what the standard for the organization is that you're inheriting, you have to, if somebody falls beneath that standard, you have to give them chances to rise above it. But if they can't rise above it, then you're best serving them by letting them go elsewhere and draw a paycheck. And you should set them up for that success for themselves. And two, a lot of leaders don't really understand that not everything can be fixed, right? I get irritated with certain people that, you know, are slower than I am. And they'll throw things at me that say like, well, Scott, I know you move at the speed of business, or I know you're busy. And I'm like, oh my God, that's such a cop-out. It's so stupid. Like, I wish you could hear the words that are coming out of your mouth right now. Like, I'm not moving at the speed of business. I'm doing what I said that we would do. So the other piece is not everything can be fixed. We have to realize that some things are just going to be that way, and you either accept it or get rid of it. But acceptance is key as well, right? If we have that empathetic lens that we're looking at things, then I'm not so prideful as to say, Heather Coons, my chief development officer, I rely on Heather for advice every day of the week almost. And I'm always talking to her. And before I make any decision corporate-wise, and my wife on a personal size, I ask them, you know, am I wrong? And it took them a long time to realize that I was being sincere when I say, am I wrong for thinking this? And now both of them, my wife, very quick to tell me, yep, you're being wrong. And she'll just walk off and let me stew on it for a while. But Otis McGregor will tell me, I'll go to Otis and say, hey, this is what I'm feeling. Am I wrong on this? And he'll tell me first and foremost, if you know Otis, don't be a victim. And so I have to caveat it with, Otis, I'm not acting like a victim. I'm just trying to figure out what my mindset here is, if I'm right or wrong. And seek that guidance, right? So if you do inherit a toxic culture, should you even be there? And a lot of us, you know, and now I will tie this to the veterans transitioning. The first job that a retiring veteran gets out of the gate, they're probably going to hate. And I say that having helped 5,000 plus veterans transition. But here's the deal. It's not indentured servitude. You don't have to stay there for the rest of your life. If you hate it and the culture sucks and it's toxic, leave, go elsewhere, set yourself up and go. But when we find ourselves in these situations and you realize that you're unhappy, it's okay to say, I'm unhappy in the situation. And now I'm at the fork in the road to where I either have to do something to fix it or go elsewhere or help others go elsewhere who are causing that unhappiness.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point.
Yes.
I'm gonna put that on auto. I'm gonna put that on auto loop over.
It's got some room tone on his brain.
Can you say that again?
Well, I only give those out sparingly.
Heather, I want you to listen. Darby said this.
Yeah, I really agree. I think, and you know, I see it more on a personal level than on a corporate level. And you know, I'll be the first to say I probably will work with a squeaky wheel way longer than I should. It's in my nature. But I think on a personal, you know, on a personal level, it's absolutely part of that self-reflection. You know, we grew up in toxic cultures, and so we get comfortable in them and we stay in them. And that's a, you know, a fundamental thing of something that we have to continually assess as humans, and having good people around you to bounce that off of and just give kind of reflection on is always really helpful.
No, I love it. And Angus is telling me to wrap up. So I'll say that if you want to, we'll have you back and dive deeper into empathy, because I think this should be titled accountability, because that's the word you threw out that drives this whole conversation. But I'd love to, you know, even bring Sherry, the radio host, in on this and talk differing perspectives and hear some stuff out and make it more of a panel discussion. But Angus, am I missing anything? Or
I'd love to I think actual three of us have another commonality that I've been thinking about is, and I always joke about my own facial features, despite what I look like underneath, I'm a raging optimist. And I always like find, no matter how dark a situation, I can find a silver lining. What I learned with Darby was sometimes go and ask someone to help you find that silver lining. But being an intentional learner and a coach, I think a good way to close out for all three of us, and I love the idea of getting Darby back for some deeper dives, is what's your biggest learning from this dialogue today?
Ladies first, Darby, I'll go to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you asked what influences I had in my life. And I think that, you know, every day I find people that I learn from every situation, and I really love it. And I, you know, the corporate leadership model is something that I really like. Never really clicked with it because it's so structured and never really felt right. But I think, you know, hearing your perspectives on it, I love that there's perspectives that out there that are willing to push the limits of what that looks like and what leadership development looks like. It, you know, very much feels to me like the box that everyone needs to check, right? They need a leadership course, check. They need a culture, yeah, diversity and inclusion course, check. And I think I'm a little burnt out with those check boxes. So I think it's really refreshing to hear that there's new perspectives out there and people are still pushing the limits on that, on what that can look like and what that can be.
Awesome. And whatever we can do to support anything, obviously we will. But I wrote it down. I was going through my 3 pages plus of iPad notes that I took here when Darby was talking. And the one that I'm going to actually put out on LinkedIn later is, perfectionism is a trauma response. That caught my ear, and I'm like, I have to text that to my sister-in-law later on. That's awesome. And I think that I could spend the next 3 hours talking about perfectionism being a trauma response. This was complete value added. Darby, I'm so thankful that you did connect with me. You forgave me for calling you Darcy. It's just, I'm not very bright. And I tell people that all the time. One of these days they'll believe me. But Darby, it was fantastic to meet you. Thank you so much for the time today. God bless all that you're doing. And I look forward to talking to you again and more.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.